I'm joined today by Brian O'Neill from Rhythm Spice, a local Boston consultant and company. Brian, can you tell us a little about who you are and what you do, please?
Yeah, so I'm a product designer and user experience consultant. I'm also a musician. I work for myself. I've had several careers in terms of full-time positions in design and development. I guess you could call me kind of a hybrid, but I've always worked under the title of a designer primarily. So I did full-time work, started interning in the late 90s, and then from about 2000 to 2006, I had full-time positions at some startups and some really big companies, and then I went solo in 2007, and I've been consulting ever since.
And design is your primary thing as opposed to development?
Correct. So this often comes up with recruiters that hit me up because, like, my resume or something will have a lot of stuff about code in it, so I'll get a lot of engineering positions, and I usually just have to explain to them, I'm a designer who also writes some code, so I do a lot of prototyping, and sometimes, you know, we express our deliverables as technically as possible when it's relevant. Sometimes the projects I'm in don't need me that far down in the weeds, but I've built some software, and actually for managing like a CRM for my music business and the record label, and managing kind of some of that stuff. So I've kind of learned to code a bit over time, which is just helps my ability to design better products and to negotiate with engineers and to call BS sometimes and that type of thing. So I think it's important for product designers, and this is something that you'll hear too in the industrial design space, is knowing the materials that you work with. So if you're designing software and you don't know anything about software or technology, it's really hard to design great software, because in order to ship great software, you usually need to understand what's buildable, you know, feasibly, what's needed in the marketplace, what do people need, and you're kind of balancing all of these things, business needs, user needs, and technical feasibility, and so I've just felt that it's important to know something about coding and engineering as well as design. But I am primarily a product designer, so I consult on user experience, I do visual design, information architecture, there's a million labels for it, but that's my primary.
It sounds a bit like the whole domain-driven design side of things, where engineers are encouraged to learn about the business domain that they're programming in for a better understanding. Mm-hmm. And you said yourself there that you kind of try to figure out what people need and people want. So does that involve interaction with the end users, or does, say, the program / project managers on the project?
So probably the most important thing, I'm specifically talking about users as the short answer to your question.
And end users.
Yes, end users. The people that are going to touch the software, which in the enterprise software world does not mean the people that buy the software, although they are stakeholders. I would call them a stakeholder as well. So you need to get friendly with the salespeople if you're in a long lead sales cycle. The people that are buying the software also need to understand the value of that, even if it's their underlings are the ones that are actually going to manage it day to day. And this happens a lot in, like, IT, for example. But probably the most important thing that designers or anybody that's touching product managers, software engineers, that they can do is to talk to and observe people in the wild using the stuff that they build. There's just nothing as powerful as the feedback that you can get from that observation and really learning to understand people's problems in the real world. It's secondhand feedback is just generally not very good. It's usually biased. Most people aren't very accurate with their feedback. And there's an empathy and a power that happens. I've seen it many times when I drag engineers along to research sessions, and they can see someone using something that they built and either struggling with it or having really good success with it. It really gets people jazzed about understanding that you're not just kind of developing and shipping this amorphous code somewhere, and you know that there's millions of people using it, but you've never actually seen anyone touch it for real. It really personalizes the experience. So I always encourage my clients and engineers alike to get involved with the research. They don't have to do it all the time, but it's the most important thing we can do to improve quality, in my opinion. So
I picked up there on you saying you had to drag engineers along.
Yes.
You find that a commonplace current?
I mean, it depends. Sometimes we drag the participants in and we'll, like, have a lunch session where we'll either watch a video or we'll actually have a remote webcam set up with the facilitator in another room, and we'll project the room video and screen into, like, a lunch room. So I've seen it done that way. So it's like, you can still eat and talk a little bit, but generally people are watching this customer go through, like, a usability evaluation, for example. And I find it's not usually totally pulling teeth. There can be reactions like, oh, well, this user error, it's the user's fault, or whatever. And yeah, I guess sometimes that might be the case. Most of the time, that's not the case. Most of the time, it's the product wasn't designed well, or we didn't understand what the problem was we were designing for, or we led with technology instead of leading with great defined problem sets and actually being really aware of what those are. So I've found lately that more and more I feel like engineers are more willing to get involved with research if they're brought in. They're not usually volunteering for it because they're under the gun to write code. And, you know, I totally understand what that's about. Get something out there and just ship it, and like the pressures and quality. There's so many other things that they could be doing. So typically it takes some cajoling, usually from the managers, to say, can I steal your guys for a bit? Can I drag them along to this, you know, research session that I want to do?
You mentioned a couple of times great design. Mm-hmm. What is great design?
So I primarily work in software and interface design. So for me, I personally like it when interfaces, there's kind of this idea of the invisible interface, the transparent interface. So when the interface is out of the way and you're just doing the tasks that you need to get done, whatever your work is that you need to do, if you don't even notice the interface, this customer can kind of breeze through stuff and they don't even realize it's there, you've done a really good job. So a lot of times, you know, people will talk about, oh, it's a beautiful interface and all of that. That's sometimes misleading, because to me, what may be happening in those cases is that there's been maybe over-decoration of the interface, or there's too much interface going on such that they would even notice it. So the transparent thing is kind of a goal that I typically go for, is to get it out of the way as much as possible. And then secondly is understanding people's defining the problem well, such that the interface that you design anticipates the problems or the things that people are going to need to do next. So a lot of times with software, we're dealing with task flows and workflows and things like this that you may be, like, say, moving something from the analog real world into the digital world. And if you have never actually seen how somebody, you know, my HR software onboards a new employee to a company. If you've never done that with the paper and pencil route, or seen an HR person do all the paper shuffling and mailing this file and getting the fingerprints or whatever the heck that they do, how can you possibly design a great online experience? Because you have no idea the politics they go through. And I have to get this form signed, but sometimes my manager can sign it, but only if he's seen page 7. And you start to see all these the realities of what it's really like to do that job. That's what we're trying to anticipate in the design. So while the data modeling or the product may just be, oh, they need a form and they post this form, it writes to the database, it returns a view back, they hit submit, and then it goes to this place and then they're done. Well, that's the basic stuff of the technology that's behind it, but that doesn't actually reflect what actually goes on behind this. It's like, oh, they don't want to push submit because they have to get the signature from this guy first, and they have to record it in this other system, and they need the ID number from that view there. But of course, you didn't print the ID number because it wasn't in the design and no one told you to, but they need to refer to it in this other blah, 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 blah. That's what, when good design anticipates all of that, you know, it's that's the good stuff to me. So,
what's an example that people would have used good design?
What's
a few of them? Is Google the search in the middle of the page, is that good design?
Well, it's not to me that the search is in the middle of the page necessarily. I think Google's thing is, one of their tenets is about, we're all about saving people's time, giving people their time back, and I think they do a pretty good job of that. Not all of their products necessarily are equally good, but generally they're trying to help people save time. So for them, getting in and getting out of search as fast as possible is what it's about. And this is why now you see more and more answers in the search results, not here are the web pages that will answer your question, but instead, here's a definition of the word that you typed in, or if you type 5 plus 2, it reports 7 back. It doesn't search the web for documents about 5 plus 2. So they espouse that save time principle, and so I think they've done a very good job with. I think it's an incredible service, to be honest. It's amazing that they they really separated. The way that they won to me was, instead of giving people back what they typed in, they gave people back what they meant.
Mm.
And that's an amazing technology hurdle, right? Because it's engineers, you think very literally, it's like, well, that's what you typed in, so that's what you should get back. It's like, no, I don't know how to spell irrigation. I spell irrigation with an A, and it's an I, so give me irrigation. It's like, of course I meant that. Like, there's no other word, like I-R-R-A. I use that because I lost the spelling bee in fourth grade on that word, so I'll never forget it. So.
And what's a good example of, let's say, a website where people, where the site interprets what a person will want to do next?
So I'll give you an example of one that wasn't and then one that was. So if you've ever used online bill pay, like at your bank, and you have to set up your payees and all this kind of stuff. So this is another example where chances are, business analyst or an engineer or somebody like this that didn't have time or didn't want to or didn't know how to think through the logic of why someone is coming to the bill pay site. So when I create a payee, most people don't go to the site to create a payee. They go to the site to pay someone money, right? So if I'm writing a check to you for something, like I'm buying your car, I don't want to create you as a payee. That's an artificial construct that's required by the database, right? I want to write you a check. So when you go there and you try to write a check and, oh, the payee doesn't exist, so make the payee. Okay, so now I go to this form and I type in the payee information because it's the first time. And I hit submit and it says payee created. And it returns you to the default view. Well, guess what? I'm not done. I need to write you a check. I didn't come here just to add you as a payee. So the write software would say, you know, type in the name of the payee, their address. How much do you want to pay them for the first check? You type all, you hit submit. It's like payee created and paid on, you know, scheduled for payment or whatever. That's what I wanted to do, was pay somebody. So like I understand that I have to go through the steps of making the payee, but anticipate my next step. So even if the system technically requires, you know, two steps, a payee account, you know, the database needs, the table of accounts needs to have a person in it before you can write a check, fine. But you should be obfuscating that stuff from the user as much as possible and make it as natural as possible. It doesn't matter. Like, I don't want to have to deal with that crud that is an example of the data model being exposed to the user. And that's usually something when I'm talking to engineers about what's wrong with something, that's often something I'll see is that they've taken database objects and exposed them. There's a list view and a detail view and an add view. And they didn't think that, like, no, writing a check is really one thing. It's either select the name or add a new name and type the amount in and hit submit. And you're thinking, no, that's two different tables because it's a many to one or many to many relationship. Fine. But the view doesn't make sense to have that separated out. So I was really happy when Fidelity, which is what I use for my banking, actually upgraded their bill payer. And now you don't have to like go to the return view and then like it actually, and it's kind of half-assed the way they do it. Cause what they do is you create the payee. It does return you to the list view, but then it immediately scrolls you down and focuses your cursor in the payment box for that person. So it's a little bit of a hack thing. And what that tells me right there is that, oh, they realized this was a problem and they did a quick fix to it because they didn't really design it right the first time. So it's better than what it was before, but you could tell it really wasn't thought out properly at the beginning. So, you know, but that's better than nothing. And I would rather have that than no fix, you know, so.
So it looks like they've had someone with UX experience into.
Probably had some feedback. Yes. And again, is it broken? No. Like, would it pass QA? Yes. It's bug free. And the business analyst or the product manager got what they asked for. It's a many, you have this many to many now. Every payee can have multiple payments and blah, you get all the benefits of the reporting and all that. So nothing is broken unless you're a designer or user experience person. You say, well, the experience sucks. But yeah, technically the code works and all the functions and features are there. So that's kind of the space that the user experience sits in, right? Is like, it's not good enough just that it's bug free. That's, you know, who cares if it's bug free? If I can't get my job done or it takes me twice as long, I don't really care. I'd almost rather have an occasional error message than like have everything else suck from an experience standpoint. Cause time is valuable, right? It's not just about the code working. It's like, save me time. I don't want to spend time writing checks, you know, like I want to spend some cashing checks.
But that is, I guess, where the split is between UX and engineers. Mm-hmm. the example you gave, I would say from the engineering perspective, yes, it's bug-free. Yes, it does what it's supposed to do.
Right.
It's captured information. Do you think it is the engineer's job to make it more usable, to make it more transparent, or is it entirely the domain of the UX?
So I think anybody that's touching the product has a response. Like, if we can all agree on what good means, and if we agree that user experience is important, or that user experience translates into dollars for the company or whatever, then yes, I do think it's the responsibility of everybody. So, of course, it's not like everybody can be a user experience designer, just like I'm not gonna be a professional software engineer, but I know enough to be dangerous, you know? I know enough to help, to sometimes go in and fix my own problems, or to negotiate with somebody on a feature that maybe it's a really heavy lift for engineering, but I can negotiate that thing, and I can sympathize with the engineering concerns and the customer concerns. And so I think if everybody is sympathizing with all of the stakeholders, the product, the engineer, and the users, we can all create better software, because we're all aware that we all have different challenges, costs, time, effort, whatever it may be. So for engineers, what I would say, the first thing is to, do you even agree that it's a problem? Like, if we don't agree that bill payment workflow that I described is a problem, then we already have a problem, because we're not even on the same page about what's important. If we do agree, then part of my thing is, like, I want engineers to be looking out for this stuff. So, like, if, for example, if they don't have a designer, they're working with a product manager, they can kind of say, that's all great, but this doesn't make sense. Wouldn't I want to write my first check the first time I'm doing this? I want to teach engineers and people that don't know design to think that way. And so we can talk about design thinking. Not all of the work that I do is about putting pixels on the page and lining them up in the visual design so much as the experience. So if I can teach people to think about task flows and, like, think about my work, like, how long is this process going to take me? Where can we reduce that effort there? And just getting engineers to think about that is powerful, because I've seen it before where you get them involved more and more as design thinkers, they start to push back on product managers in logical ways. It's no longer just about, like, well, this is really hard, or we don't have the data and the API to do that, and blah, blah, blah. Now they're saying, why do you want to do this? Like, what problem does that widget solve? You want us to add this new widget to the dashboard, but why? Like, and if that product manager can't explain why it is, it's like you can have a really good discussion there about what is the value that we're adding to the customer, and why not empower the engineer to do that? Because I'm sure, you know, your listeners, your engineering listeners, have all built software that's been tossed, or it went out the door, and then in product management changed its mind, and it was like a first draft, and it sucks, and you're kind of ashamed of it, and now it's like out there, and you know it sucks, and now they know it sucks, and you said it was going to suck the whole time. Like, I'm tired of hearing about that, and I empathize with engineers that have been through that. That sucks. So it's like, let's fix that upstream before we get to that process as much as possible, you know?
But often the case is, though, that in my own work experience, I've had times when I just don't know how to make it look good.
Sure.
And I 100% defer to the UX person.
Sure.
They'll come along and say, Brian, that's horrible. I go, is it? But how do you bridge the gap between your skills and my skills with the engineers that you've worked with?
So graphic design is part art, and it's part skill, and it's something that can be learned. I think it's something that can be learned. That area in particular takes a lot of time and effort devoted to it. So if you're under the gun to write code and you think you're going to create great visual design, like with the last 10% of your time, or I'm going to bucket a little time at the end to make it look good, you're probably going to fail 90% of the time, because getting it to look elegant and simple actually takes a lot of work. Simple is really hard to do elegantly. So everybody, I can talk about how people might be able to learn visual design, but there's not a shortcut to that. So partly what I try to work on with engineers is you probably are going to need a specialist. You're going to need somebody that knows how to do visual design to own that piece of it. But if you can become a design thinker and start to be problem oriented, like define problems really clearly, to empathize with users, to understand what they want to do, you can think about that bill pay workflow. The form might be ugly, but if you just had the first check amount on the count creation thing, you've already made the experience so much better. And if you just line the form fields up, you've done a huge thing. You would probably see instant, like if you're Amazon and you shipped a change like that, you would see a massive change in dollars per minute coming into Amazon just because you thought like a designer would, because you thought about experience. So you didn't need to have visual design chops to make an improvement over it. So I would say it's great to learn about visual design. There's courses on that. You learn a lot by copying, by stealing, by looking at stuff that you think looks good or from the people that are experts, and you kind of try to study what it is that they've done that's great. That takes time, but there's other things you can do that are not about graphic design that you can, that are part of design that, that engineers can do, and I've seen it happen, and so I have faith.
What are the steps in making a good design?
So, do you want me to answer that in the context of an engineer perhaps working on a design project, or how I would do that, like as a designer? Because they're not necessarily the same thing.
How about a bit of both? Or where you think it's applicable to go from one to the other, where you might hand off something to an engineer?
Yeah, so most of the time, what I see these days is that I get projects where usually it's voiced as a requirement. We need to allow people to search on this new attribute that we didn't have before. And so I'll say, well, why do we need to do that? And we'll go through this dialogue there. And sometimes they say, well, you're just being a pain in the butt. And it's like, no, I'm actually trying to understand what problem adding this new drop down to the search is going to solve. Because maybe that's not the way to do it. Maybe it is. I'm not making any judgments about that. But a lot of what I do now focuses on what we would call laddering. So I'm going to say, why? And they'll say, well, because it's in the API feed. Okay, well, why is it in the API? Like, why did they put it in the API? Oh, well, because it, you know, now we have gender, the feed has gender in it, and it has an age group range in it, and it has favorite color. And it's like, well, why do they think in the context of signing up for a race, favorite color is needed? And so we call this laddering, and I'm going to keep asking why. And at some point, you hit this point, which is a goal. It's like, because the user is trying to sign up for the race, and their secret code word for their password is going to be their favorite color, and that's why it's in the feed. Oh, okay, so really they're trying to sign up. So their goal is, I want to sign up for the race, and you need a secret key, which is your favorite color. Yes, that's what it is. Okay, so nowhere was that written down anywhere. And so you get it, by the time it gets to the engineer, it's just a drop down on the page. You have no context for why it's there, but you were told to put it on the page. And so you write all this code and you do all of that. So as a designer, I spend a lot of time with product management or stakeholders or sometimes engineers about why are we doing this and what are we trying to solve? And is that really the best way to do it? So problem definition is probably the first thing that you need to do. The second thing, if we're getting into the mechanics of it, I've just boiled my design process down to, I may do some research if I feel like the problem needs to define more. I may talk to some customers about it. It kind of depends are we doing an iteration on something that exists that we've studied before? And I'm a product designer that's been in a company for, several years. So I kind of know the context I'm working in versus a brand new project. So I might do some research to talk to customers and understand needs and that kind of thing. Or I may jump into design. And so at that point, I usually do a low fidelity pass and a high fidelity pass. This is another place where I think engineers can be participants in the process. Everybody can sketch. And sketching is not about illustrating or being beautiful. Sketching is about expressing ideas visually. So I don't know about you. In my experience, when I've seen requirements documents written often by business analysts of financial services companies, love these. They get their 50-page requirements document. And if you have a design that's even a napkin sketch, or you have a whiteboard sketch of here's two forms and there's this view and there's a chart here, all the engineers jump to the screen design. They want to see what this thing looks like. They start processing like, okay, so there's this thing. Oh, we don't have a model for that. So there's new, where's the data coming from that? The visualization of the design is so much more powerful than reading a 50-page document that chances are was not written very well anyways. It has problems in it. It has holes in it. It's going to be misinterpreted. And so I try to encourage engineers or anyone doing that to take out the pencil and paper and don't use balsamic, don't use digital tools, use low fidelity prototyping tools, sketch out what it looks like, throw out the ones that don't work. Like, spend some time on paper and pencil. I actually prefer whiteboards because A, you can erase. B, it's easier to get a group of people together, and everybody can kind of jam the ideas out together, and it's not about who's the best drawer and, you know, illustrator or whatever. So I like the collaboration of whiteboards, and just get your phone out, you take a picture of it, put a date on it, attach it to the Trello card or whatever you're using for your thing, and it's like, now you've got to start at the design. So I usually do a lot of sketching, a lot of low fidelity stuff to kind of jam ideas out. I may or may not share those with the client or my team or whatever. I may go right into visual design or what I would call high fidelity design. So that may either be pixels, Photoshop, or I use OmniGraph a lot. It may be a prototype. For example, if I'm coming in on a product that exists on the web, I may either ask for a branch of code to be released for me. That's my playground so that I can, like, do whatever I want and break stuff safely. Or I may create a prototype or something like that and express the changes that way. So it kind of depends on, like, financial services data. It's actually easier to work in HTML because you don't spend all this time lining up columns and rows of numbers and charts and all this stuff. That takes a lot of time, which is wasted. It's production time. It's tool time. It's not design time. So HTML is actually easier because you get all the benefits of the alignment and the style sheets, you know, controlling everything. So generally I go through that, and then there may be a round of testing that we do to validate our choices. So we go talk to some users, we show it to some people, we test scientifically how well we're achieving our goals, and then we either do a release or we do an iteration or whatever it may be. But that's kind of the high-level process that I go through. So,
as engineers, though, we often start with the data model at the database.
Sure.
We need this table, it's linked to that table.
Sure.
Do you view that as the wrong side to start from?
Yes, because all of that stuff, so that the mental model is the model that people have in their heads about how things work. And the one of the examples I give in the presentation on design thinking is, if you've ever looked at subway maps before, subway maps, all the turns are at 45 or 90 degree angles. You will rarely see a subway map that has, like, a train going off at a 30 degree angle and then turning. They don't represent the actual map that you would see if you pulled up Google Maps. They represent what we think, and most humans tend to think of turn right, turn left. They're nice, neat 90 degree turns. 45, you kind of know, oh, that's a diagonal street, so it's 45. But we don't process mentally things much more complicated. And so it actually makes the map much easier to read. So it is important to start with the mental model and to try to model your designs around that and not to jump into the data model, because chances are the expression of the data model into the UI is not going to be intuitive more times than not. Sometimes it is, you know, and sometimes it's a good start, but especially with really complicated applications, most of the time it is not. Like, like I said, when you're onboarding this person, like, at a new company, they might need to interact with 5 different, you know, HR systems and the Oracle database and our CRM, blah, blah, blah. I don't want to have to expose that to people because this person probably has no idea where that it's going to offsite data storage and it's going to the cloud and it's going, you don't want to expose that stuff to them. So if you started the data model and exposing that, you're already kind of going to be fighting that design by the time you start, you know, adding your code and building on top of the spaghetti pile. By the time you say, okay, let's do some design now, it's like, well, you've already invested all this code into whatever you have as your UI, and now you have a high switching cost, both for users, you have a lot of baggage, technical baggage to carry along. So if someone had spent some time sketching on paper or, you know, hiring a designer or whatever it may be, you can probably save some engineering cycles as well. It should make your life easier as well. But I mean, data model, of course, it's a required process, but the best data modeling in the world is not going to create the best experience. It enables a great experience to happen. So
you mentioned earlier, though, that a UI should be prepared to take a person to their next step in a task. But as an engineer, that can be an incredibly hard thing to do if you don't have a linear path through some logic. If you're able to jump from A to C to F to B, are you advocating something very flexible or flexible within certain constraints?
Yeah, I think so. You don't need to go from every path possible isn't what we're trying to enable in the design. That's not good, because what you've done is you've presented every single choice to the customer. Now, do whatever you want to do at any time you want to do it. It's like, no. It's, if you remember, like, the old Microsoft Word, they shot themselves in the foot. Like, they kept adding toolbars and toolbars and toolbars and toolbars until, if you remember, there was a point where it was like 15 rows of icons, which no one could decipher. Instead of thinking contextually, when I'm working on a table, what choices in the navigation or the icons or the actions would I want? Well, probably table-related stuff. So give me that context menu, that menu in the context I'm working at the right time. Right information at the right time. So that's a big part of it. So it's not that I want people to be able to go anywhere. I want to figure out from talking to people and understanding what they need, that they need to go from A to D to F. And we have A to B to D to F. They don't want to go through B every time. They type that in a million times. They don't need to type their, they don't need to validate their email address when they sign up again. They just did that when they signed up last week. So don't ask them to check it again on page 2. I want them to be able to just skip right over it. And it's because I know that problem exists. It's not because I wanted infinite choice or whatever. I've spent some time thinking through that that's the right experience. So
do you think that's a good reason why engineers should interview the users to get their perspective on the usage of the app?
Well, right. So how, if you said, for example, it's hard to go from A to C to D if you don't go through B, you might change your perspective if you saw, well, our current thing goes A, B, C, D. So if you went and saw somebody struggle to death to, like, register for the race or whatever it may be because you asked for a passport number, and at no time on page 1 did you ever say we're going to need your passport number when you sign up. So, and you know they're doing this on the phone, and you know they're, like, you know, I don't know, they're at work. So there's a good chance they don't have their passport at it. But you said they had to do this. If you've never seen someone struggle with that, and the fact that, oh, I can't save the data on page 1 unless I get through page 4. So you made me type in 50 form fields. I went to page 2. You asked for my passport number. I don't have my passport. It's like, they're so angry at that point because now they got to fill in all of page 1 and all the questionnaire crap again when they get home. So they got to do it twice. They lost all their data, and I don't even know where my freaking passport is, and you haven't even told me why you need my passport, because there's no information on the page that says why I should give you that value that you think that you need. An engineer is never going to know that if they haven't ever talked to somebody, because again, does it work? Yes, the error checking works, the QA pass, the unit testing worked, the bot could go through and sign up, blah, 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 code free. But you might have a piece of crap on your hands, and you're never going to know it because you've never seen it. So, and I'm not putting down all engineers, like, say, oh, they want it to be that way. No one wants to spend time writing code on products that don't make sense. But it's very easy for us to self-reflect and say, hey, it works for me. I got through it. We call that self-reflection. And it's easy for us to convince ourselves our stuff is good because we look at it all day long. It's so intuitive because we know where all the workarounds and the buttons and the settings are, and it keeps you from going native. That's why you gotta have ongoing, there's actually a new study that I think Jared Spool did that said the best teams doing great quality product design are talking to customers at least once every 6 weeks. And they see there's a correlation there between the quality of the products coming out when there's a minimum of a 6 week touch point with customers. So I'm going to throw out 6 weeks. It's like, if you're not talking to people at least every 6 weeks, you're probably gone native.
Do you see the introduction of Agile in most companies as helping this process where a developer talks to a user, gets some feedback, iterates, talks to a user, iterates?
No, I don't. I've read about primarily Scrum. First of all, the agility part of Agile is largely lost. I see a lot of waterfall that's basically been retitled as Agile, and they're really doing incremental design. So what do I mean by that? It's like, oh, we need to build this big system, and we're gonna build the infrastructure, and then we're gonna like get the data feeds in, and then we're gonna do this thing. It's like, no, you're doing incremental design. You're slowly building the house. And Agile is really about, you build a house in the first pass, and you get some feedback on the house, and then you make the house better. You don't incrementally, like, add a door, and then, oh, we need a rooms. Okay, let's add some rooms. We only had a found. No. And so that's the Agile thing I think gets tossed around is, oh, we're now fast, or we ship code every 2 weeks, but the spirit of getting feedback gets lost. Most of the time, I don't see a user representative, which is supposed to be a designer or a customer if you're doing Scrum. That person is dramatically absent most of the time when there is nobody performing that role, or it's the product manager. The guy that gets to control the funds and resources is that person, which defeats the whole idea of having an objective person that represents the customer there. So it doesn't mean agile is bad. It all comes down to who is doing the work, and are we fooling ourselves, or are we being really true, you know, to what we need to do to make great products? So agile isn't necessarily bad, but that's a whole nother topic. But I think the agility part has gotten lost with some of the intent there has been lost.
So have you seen some companies doing good iterations?
Well, so I think whatever works for your team is what matters. So every place I go, they have their own flavor. Some places do stand-up, some do Scrum, but they don't do stand-up. So you have 4-week sprints, 2-week sprints. There's no ever the product leader rotates. The product leader is the same person every time. I've seen every flavor of it, and I don't think there's a right or wrong. I think it's whatever helps you deliver value, like, regularly to the business and regularly to the customer. And if you're out there talking to customers and you factually are measuring your success, right? Somehow you do something to validate that the work you're doing is good or bad. And if you can put that into a process and repeat it, then it doesn't matter what you call it or whatever. And that was really the spirit of Agile to me, was like, let's stop thinking that we can predict and boil, you know, we can boil the ocean, we can write a 50-page requirements document, we can actually factually estimate when it's going to be done. Like, get over it. You're never going to be accurate with that estimate. It's never going to go as planned. Start with a smaller project and try to have some repeatable process that ensures quality. So whatever works for that personalities, and sometimes a distributed team is different than a team that's localized on which process works or whatever. I will say one thing about, like, on design with Agile, because design was never part of Agile. And so what I like to do is, when I come into a company that doesn't have design, is I like to talk about building up the runway of projects. So we'll do a bunch of work to create design artifacts that are code ready. Like, we don't need to be discovering what the right product is. We don't need to have as much negotiation on should it be this way or should it be that way. It should come down to, okay, let's size this finished piece of work. It should just come down to engineering execution at that point. Sometimes you gotta, like, pull some stuff out, or there needs to be a negotiation, like, well, we love the design, but it's gonna take 6 months and we have 6 weeks. So now we need to revisit the design and water it down a bit or whatever. That's fine. But I like to do, like, these zero sprints and build some runway, and generally keep the designer one sprint ahead of the engineers. And so the idea is they're constantly building out this runway. And as needed, if there's a problem, the designer stops working on the N plus one sprint, goes back to the N sprint with the engineers, and services the people that are doing the real sprint the company cares about, which is the one that has the code. And they address those problems, or they renegotiate, or whatever. But having that runway, I find a lot of architects and engineering managers like having some finished quality products that they know are going to change, and, like, it's a little bit de-risked from an engineering stance. Someone thought through this design. There's a reason that thing's on the page. We may not even care because we're under the gun, but we know that Brian, or we know the design team or whatever, thought that through, and it makes sense. You know, so that's kind of how I like to do it, but we ship and iterate and, you know.
So how does that fit with iterations, let's say, of the UX person's one iteration ahead, and they've decided, I'm going to change a lot of different things, which will have a huge impact, say, on the engineering team's work. How is a negotiation formed there between what the UX person thinks is required and what the engineering team can actually do in a given time period?
Well, to me, it's the product management's job to own the backlog and to decide. Somebody has to own what we're going to work on and where we're going to spend our dollars and time, right? So hopefully we're not making those kinds of dramatic changes unless it's through the process of, okay, we did our best bet. We went out and tested this thing and it failed miserably. Like, we have a real problem on our hands. If that's what we found out, then yes, it does mean we're going to throw out a lot of code, a lot of design time, and a lot of money. But we know that our first thing was wrong. So what value is there in keeping it? No matter how big of an engineering lift it is, we're not providing any value. So what are we doing here at that point? You need to change. You do need to be doing the validation loops. You do need to be keeping the team involved with that. And so when we do research, to me, our findings aren't just limited to sharing with the business, but the engineers should also be aware of, like, hey, we did this study. Like, here's what we learned last week. We talked to some customers. Hey, they hate this feature. And why I actually don't care if people like features. Like, one of the worst things you can do in research is ask people what they like. What I care about is what they do when they're given a task. Can they finish it or not? Was it useful? Was it usable? How did they react to it? So we can give feedback like, hey, you know, we did that mapping thing and no one can really figure out what it means to say return address. They like to call it the from address or whatever. Like, that was really confusing and we can scientifically test that or whatever. I like to get that feedback back to the engineer so they know that, like, someone's actually out there looking at this stuff and we're actually making sure that what we're doing is right so that you don't feel like, oh, we're just, oh, here we go again, building another massive project. And it's like, no, we have no idea if anyone even cares about this. It's like, isn't it nice to know that, like, yeah, someone used that last week and they loved it. And even in passing along the successes too, like, that was a real win, man. They love it when you, like, you know, TurboTax, it calculates your refund. Like, maybe that was a really hard JavaScript thing for the front end guy to do that calculator that's got to process like 50,000 form fields and then dynamically figure out what your return is. And it looks like you could see someone pushing back all to print one number on the frickin' screen. And I tell you how many people have mentioned that they love seeing what their tax return, their rebate is going to be as they work on it. It's a kick-ass experience. It's a really good experience. And it might have been a really hard engineering lift, but if no one ever shares that with the engineers, it's like they're not going to be inclined to do it the second time. Like, oh, now we want to show, you know, your next year's return, your anticipated tax return. They're probably like, why should I spend time on this?
But then you got very different definitions for success from a user experience and from an engineering perspective then. How do you get those to reconcile?
So, I mean, my job is not to write the code properly, to test it and all of that. So, like, I don't generally have to get involved with that. And I respect that that stuff is important. And I understand that if we skip that stuff in the name of adding features, all you do is add risk for the future. You're just adding more and more risk. And at some point, you might have to do a rewrite because you skipped all the testing in order to fit more features in. I understand that there's cost for that, but I also understand that I've seen plenty of projects where it's like, yeah, it's a feature-rich product that sucks because the experience is terrible and either people aren't buying it or they're going to our competitors or whatever. So I don't even care how stable the code is at this point. We need to change this thing or else we're screwed. Like, we're not going to be in business or we're not, whatever our goals are. What difference does it make if the code's been tested? It doesn't matter at that point. So, you know, it's really engineers' space to know how to validate their success criteria and to have success criteria and define those. And as a business or a product designers, we need to talk about success from the user experience standpoint. And hopefully we're all aware of each other's goals, right? And our success criteria. Like, we want 20% more signups and you want to make sure that, you know, we're not hitting the database. You know, we're expecting a huge low. We can't be hitting the database every time. So this number may only update, you know, it might be wrong, you know, 5% of the time. We have some negotiation about the trade-offs on that kind of thing. And hopefully we can come to consensus that, oh, that's a fair trade-off. So fine. We'll make sure there's going to be 5% error rate, but we think with all the increased signups, it's net better and you have that little negotiation or whatever. So I don't know if that answers the question.
But you think it's very important to define what success is before a project and keep track of it as you move along?
Oh, certainly. I mean, that's usually part of when, so I was talking about the problem definition piece at the top. Well, when you do that laddering process and you keep asking why, it's like at some point you get to that thing, which is like, well, because the business wants to know, like, how much more availability can they expose to their technicians that need to do work? We don't have any transparency to that. We could do more work if we knew how much capacity our guys had. So the CEO wants a number that's a percent, you know, this number divided by that number turned into a percentage or whatever it may be. I'd say, okay, so now what you're saying is if we get feedback that he can figure out what this index number that we came up with, if he can conclude that that number is his company's resource availability number, then we're going to be selling some stuff and people are going to be, yeah, that's what I mean. Okay, good. We can test that. And so absolutely we go through that process of setting that. Does it get skipped? It gets skipped all the time. I work on stuff all the time where there's no success criteria developed. And it's usually, you know, I usually fill out my clients, like, how much time do they want to spend on this? And usually what happens is we waited till we hit a brick wall or, you know, the CE comes in, CEO comes in, or someone comes in that's really upset about something we pushed out, or they wonder about something, and then I kind of stop and say, okay, well, this is what happens when we don't talk about success criteria. We're not all aligned. So now that we've had a fire, let's talk about success criteria. And, you know, sometimes you have to fail before, you know, before you can move on something. And so I usually, you know, as a consultant, I have to balance that, like, how much upfront time do we want to spend talking about it versus just doing it. So,
but sometimes I get the impression that consultants, in a lot of ways, have more freedom in this matter, because it might be something that a person with an engineering team wants to express, but they won't be listened to, whereas the outside expert will be listened to.
Well, I mean, that's a whole other, that happens all the time. Yeah. Consultants are brought, like, the resident knowledge is already in the building, but until it comes from an outside source that's perceived as an expert or a neutral party, you know, that thing doesn't get adopted. Like, my fiance says we get called in a lot because the business is stalled. You know, engineering's warring with the business and marketing wants this, and they know what to do. Like, somebody knows what to do, and we just talk to everybody and we agree, or we'll agree with somebody. It's like, well, we agree with engineering. Like, you guys have a huge risk problem here, and if you don't do that, you're going to be totally screwed. Oh, okay, well, we better fix that then. Yeah. I totally resonate. I mean, I understand that, but I do, as a consultant, I try to feel more like an employee when I'm on a team. I don't want to be treated as a consultant. I want to be a part-time employee, essentially, and to share in that process. It's not about being an outsider, I guess, at least. That's how I try to work, at least, so.
There was a company I was working at a while back, and one of the engineering staff wanted to put a message of the day on the front page in, I think it was flashing yellow and red scrolling text. Now, the UX team obviously vetoed that, but those kind of conflicts were happening fairly frequently. In your own experience, have you come across those kind of troubles?
Yeah, so I think one of the things that's hard for engineers sometimes, in my experience, is if they can't get an answer that they feel is believable or rooted in fact enough, they tend to question it, or they think, you're the designer, so you just have this, like, magic decision-making power that, like, you don't have to explain the rationale for any of your stuff, but, like, I have to explain myself to death when I say, oh, we can't do that. Oh, why can't we? It's so easy. Like, Amazon does it. Why can't we do it? Or, like, So my comments on that, it's with younger designers, and I'm talking about experience, some great designers don't know, they can't justify the reasons for doing their stuff, but that doesn't necessarily mean they don't know what they're doing, because there is an intuition that happens through the process of doing design. You get better at it, and you might just have intuition about what is good. As you get more seasoned, and what I've learned is that being able to explain and rationalize why you put stuff on the page and where you put it on the page, and explaining to an engineer or to somebody that it's not so much that this one thing that you want is wrong, it's the fact that we have 20 of these little tiny things that don't seem very major, but when you add all those things up into the experience, it's not good. And so we want to stop having, like, flashing messages everywhere, or we don't want to keep repeating this stuff. We actually have a project right now to reduce some of this. So it's not that one thing is bad. It's the sum of all of the, like, capitalization. Could you please change this and make it title? Okay. Fuck. It's like, I don't have time for that. Like, I'm back end coder. We have QA fixing and you want me to change the case of the letters and the strings. And it's like, well, you don't think that's important, but the sum of all of those spelling errors and the title stuff is a judgment of the it makes us look like we ship stuff fast, we're sloppy, we don't know how to spell, and it's like, what kind, do I want to do service with a bank that kind of, like, has stuff like that? It makes you kind of wonder, like, they didn't spend time to, like, put the case right on it. And so a lot of engineers might not think about it. It's not wrong, but the sum of those emotional judgments people are going to make are important. So hopefully the designer can have that kind of discussion about why they want something to be a certain way and justify this in a way. And as you get more seasoned as a designer, you learn how to justify these kinds of things and settle this stuff. At the end of the day, somebody has to make a decision, though. And if it's a design decision, they should make it. And if it's an engineering decision, the engineer should make it. And hopefully it doesn't come to that point. Sometimes it does, and someone needs to put a stake in the ground and say, look, it would take us a year to validate this decision, and I'm going with my gut and my experience, and this is what we're going to do. And, you know, a lot of times for me, it's like I'm trying to get the team to do that or the product manager. It's like if there's a battle, it's like, look, You're never going to prove it. Engineer is never going to be able to prove their hypothesis, and neither is product. So someone has to be empowered to make a decision. Let's make one, do something, test it, and now we have a basis, right? If we don't know how people are going to sign up, then let's stop talking about the number. Let's just get it out there, measure the signups. Okay, it's 7 per week. Great. Let's go for 10 now. Like, if you know, that magic number is 7. You don't know it's 7. It's stop talking about it. Like, get it out, measure it, and then move on. And so that's kind of how I like to get around debate, is to give ownership in those sections. But you should be able to justify and bring the team along, and your reasoning is why that's there. But with junior people, you don't get that as much. You know, it would be really hard. I mean, the classic engineering response, I love this, which is, it's always the features they don't want to work on that take the longest. But if they're really jazzed about something, oh, we're going to do a map integration, and like, I haven't done anything with the Google Maps API, all of a sudden, oh, I could do that in a weekend.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
So I always find that one kind of interesting, and the business hates that. And so a lot of times the designer with tech chops, I'm kind of calling some BS here, or I might be kind of giving the product manager, it's like, look, they say this is a huge lift, but there's a free mapping API out there already. We already have Google products. The mapping API is free. It's not going to cost. I built a prototype last weekend, and I don't even know what I'm doing. So it's BS when they say we can't, you know, map our addresses or put markers for all the, bank locations on the map or whatever. It's kind of BS. And so I try to empower them to understand the technology a little bit better so that, and then when the product manager comes to the engineer and says, hey, I heard this is easy. It's like, I built this free prototype with this tool that uses that called, JS Fiddle. Like, I don't even know what I'm doing, but I did this thing. And it's like, now the engineers have a little more respect because they know that the product manager knows a little bit about the pains and the technology and what's possible. And so there's a little more respect has now been created there between those two, departments or whatever. So I don't know. I don't know if that helps, but that's kind of how I look at the.
No, it seems like it's a matter of sort of a longer term relationship and trust in.
Sure. And educating, not because I said so, but like, here's why we do it that way. Like, or here's a study on that. I read this study and it said the login box is better on the left. Like, it's 56% more clicks than when it's on the left side. It's not that the right is wrong. It's just, why not get that free win when it's otherwise it's an arbitrary decision. We went with the left side. That's why it's there. Could you please move it? I know it's a CSS layout change. I know it sucks, but wouldn't you like to get a 56% click increase? If we might get it and it's 2 hours of work, let's just do it.
Like, and that's a real statistic?
No, that's okay. A totally made up.
Okay. I was thinking, I was just running through examples in my head of places that have logins on the right.
Totally. Yeah. But if you don't give the explanation, it sounds like another arbitrary engineering, like a pixel pushing change, which I know a lot of, unless you do front end code, most engineers that write software don't want to be doing layout changes and that kind of stuff, and they don't know what the value of those changes are. And so,
You say that so convincingly now that I'm not sure I want to trust my UX designer next time.
Yeah. Well, maybe you have to give them a little bit of stuff because not every answer is going to have a quantitative justification. It looks right, or like it just feels right, or whatever. It could be opinions, but expertise comes in different forms, and experience is one of the big ones, and we can't always explain our experiences away and, in ways someone's going to understand. It's just, I've seen it that way a million times. I don't want to innovate on the placement. Like, why don't we use the left side like everyone else does? Please move it off the right onto the left. Like, and my reason is because I don't want to be different than everyone else. I want to be the same. We don't want to innovate with the, the login box placement, so... or something like that might be my reason, is just I don't want it to be different because I don't want people to stop and think about it.
But one of the things you said in one of your presentations I watched was, don't do something just because someone else is doing it either.
Yes, and that's because I find a lot of times there's not necessarily thought given to why something is the way it is. And the first thing I'll often hear product managers do is they don't want to spend designing it. So like, well, what did all the competitors do? Like, let's just learn from them. They already spent all this money figuring out what to do. And I'm like, are you sure about that? Because a lot of them just look for somewhere else. And it's like everyone's doing derivative work with no thought. And then all of a sudden this innovator comes out of nowhere and bam, like they all of a sudden do something totally different. It's like, well, guess what? They studied the problem. Like that's usually what happens is it wasn't some magic designer came in with this amazing idea that just comes to them, this flash of light. It's like they probably went through some process and really figured out why that thing was wrong. Like they found a problem that we didn't even know existed. And that's where that innovation came from. So it's,
At the end of each of my podcasts, I've included a piece of music that I found on various free music websites that are published under Creative Commons. But this time, my guest, Brian, is a musician, and we're going to be closing with one of his pieces of music. Can you tell me a little bit about your musical endeavors?
Sure, yeah. So my formal training is not in design or product design. It's in music. I have a percussion performance degree from Northern Arizona University, and so I studied music for most of my life and majored in percussion studies, and I still freelance around Boston as a performer. So I have a band that I run, and then I'm a sideman in several different projects, and then I do some orchestral and show freelancing as well. So I think you picked a song from that I wrote for my quintet. So I have a band called Mr. Ho's Orchestratica, and there's a 22-piece formation that plays the lost music of Juan Garcia Esquivel, and there's a quintet, a 5-piece group that plays mostly original compositions that are sort of a blend of jazz, chamber music, and global rhythms and sounds that I kind of put together, and they're both instrumental ensembles primarily. And so this tune is called "Would You Like Bongos with That Fugue?" And people always love the title of this tune, and I gave myself a challenge when I wrote this to, I always wanted to write a fugue, which is a very old style of composition that's it's kind of hard to explain, but there's sort of like several melodies going on in the tune at the same time. And putting these together in a way that actually sounds logical and intelligent is a real craft. And Bach was known as a real master of the fugue art form. So I only got through about eight bars of my fugue, and I kind of was like, wow, this is really difficult to do. And so I kind of decided to bring in the other elements of my music. And so I added some different rhythms. I actually brought in some Bach pieces that I changed the time signatures around and put some little hints at the Bach toccata and fugue in D minor and the G minor violin fugue, which I actually played on a recital at one time, and kind of slammed all these things together. And for rhythm, I was like, well, what's the most outlandish thing that you could ever put with a fugue? Because we like to do things a little bit differently in the orchestratica. And I was like, well, bongos or percussion would be pretty strange. You would not hear that like in an organ fugue from, you know, 1790, for example. So that's where the title "Would You Like Bongos with That Fugue" came from. So this is on our latest album, which is called "Where Here Meets There."
Do you play around Boston often?
We do. Yeah, we travel and tour a little bit, and then we play in Boston a couple times a year, about once a quarter. So we play at the Regatta Bar quite frequently, and we play at the Lily Pad, which is a great jazz and creative music space in Inman Square, Cambridge. And then we tour sometimes. We did Arizona last year, and we play in New York and D.C. and stuff like that. And then the big bands toured internationally and in Montreal Jazz Festival and different Berlin and different places. So
nice.
Yeah, so...
Are there a few books or authors that might be of use to engineers with regards to data visualization?
Yes. So there's two big ones. There's three. There's a newer one by the guy that does a lot of the work for the New York Times. I can't remember his name, but he does a lot of the data visualization stuff. When you see some of these really elegant New York Times articles that have supporting graphics, he's actually a programmer as well. So he kind of sits in this space between designer, developer. He knows the data. He knows how to parse data and do all that kind of stuff. So I can't remember his name offhand.
I'll find it and
yeah,
I'll put it as a
if
link.
If you look it up, New York Times, data visualization designer or something, you'll probably see it. It's an Asian guy, I believe. So there's two other names, Edward Tufte. Is a big one, T-U-F-T-E. He is a professor at Yale, and he does a lot of work with data visualization, and also he's also an artist as well, but he has some very beautiful textbooks about throughout history how graphics and visual information, specifically quantitative information, can be displayed, and how texts, words and charts and all these things can be brought together to give a lot more compelling information to people when you're reading stuff. So he talks a lot about the problems of PowerPoint and delivering, you know, very data-free, you know, not low-density information to people, and how the problems with data, you know, people talk about information overload, and his big thing is it's not information overload, it's a lack of designed information, that, you know, the clarity of the information is not coming out because it hasn't been processed properly. So Tufte is good at, I think, at kind of showing you what the world could be and what people have done with things. When it comes to practice, I've been reading Stephen Few's books a little bit or scanning his. He is much more practical and probably more what engineers might be interested in, which is like, how do you design a good dashboard? And like, he gives examples of what dashboards are, and he kind of works it a little bit backwards, but why did we arrive at this dashboard? Well, here's a, you know, display of three quality attributes on a time scale, and it's a sparkline graphic, and it's look how small it is, but we can still, you know, we can still show multiple pieces of data in a very small piece of real estate. And he'll give examples of that, and he'll sometimes show examples of what not to do. Why is a pie chart bad? And give you a very practical, display of that. So Tufte's things, I feel like a lot of his things don't go enough into software. Like when he talks about like displaying great charts and histograms, but it's like, well, but now charts are all displayed on the fly. Like the data is dynamic. So like, even though it's nice to, you know, label each, line on a line chart on the chart, like if there's a point of interest, you want that label right there. That's really hard because now the software needs to know where to place the label so it doesn't obfuscate the data. And there's an engineering challenge there. And so we end up putting the legends off to the right or, you know, they're off the charting area. And so I think, Stephen Few's books are a little bit, better at practical, like software kind of stuff. But Tufte has done a lot more research and kind of, he's more the academic science guy behind that. And the cool thing about Tufte is he comes around and does workshops that you can take. They're really cheap. I think it's like $100 and it'll be like at a hotel ballroom with 500 people. But you get his books, which are, they're really nice, like college textbooks with beautiful illustrations. You get the books as part of the, taking the course. And so it's very funny. He's very academic. You don't get to read. He only takes questions at the end. So he's like, put your hands down. This isn't a discussion. And so he kind of gives like this very, academic thing, but he knows his material very well. And he is open to what office hours, which is, it's very formal, but he has his office hours at the end of the presentation. But the books alone are, it's worth going to it just to buy the books instead of buying the books rather. So, so watch for his tours. He hits the major cities and does that every year. So I encourage people to go to that. So
thank you very much, Brian O'Neill, for joining me.
Yeah,
today.
Thanks for having me.
opening music was the return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Would You Like Bongos with That Fugue from the album Where Here Meets There from Mr. Ho's Orchestratica.